The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simplify now till you are not allowed to criticize. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Good morning, and welcome to today's episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents, originally recorded and broadcast on Friday, September the 11th, 2026, at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. Today's episode is entitled The Films of David Lynch. The time is 7:53 over here in London, England, and it is nice to be presenting new content for you again. Yes, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me arrived. For those of you who heard me mention it on yesterday's show on the films of David Cronenberg, I was waiting on that until I could do the films of David Lynch. It arrived at 5 o'clock in the evening, so it's pretty late, isn't it, for a postal delivery, but better late than never. I watched it, I digested it, and I have it ready for today's show. So let's go over to the David Lynch page, a Wikipedia page, and then we click on the filmography section on the left-hand column, and we start off with Eraserhead from 1977. Now, this is one of these films. There was a film magazine, I think it had probably Premiere or Empire, and you've got a free poster. I think it had Eraserhead on one side and Mean Streets on the other, something like that. And that was up on my wall when I was a student. And I looked at it recently. I actually had to look at this because it's been so long since I saw it. And I felt that it was the story. It's very difficult to understand. It's very visual. It's black and white. I believe that the character, Eraserhead, is actually Lynch himself. It's based on himself. The reason is when you look at David Lynch, throughout his life, he had a hairstyle that was very short on the sides, but it was all built up on the top. And sometimes it was quite high on the top. And that's where you get the eraser head. It looks like the eraser on top of a pencil, the hair. Do you see what I mean? And I feel that that is why that character was based on Lynch. It's one aspect, anyway. Another aspect is that he won't actually talk about his films generally, their meaning, what have you. He leaves it open for people. But essentially, it looks like it was about him becoming a father and his fears about becoming a father. And that is echoed in the film. So let me describe the film. You've got this guy, Eraserhead, if you like, I believe played by Jack Nance. And he's wandering around like almost like a desolate landscape in sections. And then you've got like old warehouses and all sorts of weird backdrops. And you've got strange music effects going on in the background. And not a lot seems to be happening. And then at one point, he's with a girl, her family, and she produces, well, what's supposed to be a baby, but it's some horrible-looking thing wrapped in bandages. You can just see its head. And she ends up leaving him, and he has to care for this baby. And then the baby, I presume it's measles, gets all these spots over his face, and it just cries and cries constantly. And of course, I mean, you know, this grates on you after a period of time. I mean, it's a bit like in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre film, the scene at the dinner table where the woman just, the girl just, you know, late teens, whatever, student, I guess, that sort of thing, just can't stop screaming. And, I mean, you can appreciate her plight and the way it's done, but at the same time, it grates on the ears. And that's similar with this Eraserhead baby. And consequently, he's looking after the baby. All sorts of weird imagery goes on. It's very difficult to understand what's going on. But it takes my mind back to those student days. And films like David Lynch, how many of us at the time when we were saying, oh, yeah, well, watch Eraserhead, got to see that, would actually have preferred to see the latest James Bond film, but we didn't want to appear uncool to our contemporaries, and so we went along with the David Lynch-style thing. I mean, I remember sitting around with some, there were three of us at university, and we were sitting around, and one of them wanted to get hire out Peter Greenaway's The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover. And I was sat there watching it with them, and at one point I just complained about it, and one of them said, oh, don't you want to watch a bit of culture? And you know, that was why we were there. You know, we were students, so we should watch something like this. It's not for personal interest. It's because we feel we have to. Funnily enough, whenever I said that during the film did get better, and it has ended up being one of my favourite films. It's the only film of Peter Greenaway's that I've seen that I actually enjoy. But going back to Eraserhead, on the Wikipedia page for Eraserhead, under the legacy section, it says this that I found rather interesting. While working on The Elephant Man, Lynch met American director Stanley Kubrick, who revealed to Lynch that Eraserhead was his favourite film. Eraserhead also served as an influence on Kubrick's 1980 film The Shining. Kubrick reportedly screened the film for the cast and crew to put them in the mood that he wanted the film to achieve. Now, I would never have put Eraserhead and The Shining together at all, but I found that to be a rather interesting anecdote. But what you're going to find as we go through the films of David Lynch is I can't tell you much about them, because I can't understand a lot of them, okay? But I have gone through them, and I want to give you my honest reaction. And there are people out there that will tell you that David Lynch is the best thing since sliced bread, and maybe he is if you have the ability to understand what he's doing. But unfortunately, in many of his films, as you will find out in this broadcast, I do not understand. One that I do understand is his next film, The Elephant Man, which was brought out in 1980. Now, people would imagine something like Eraserhead would be some art house production, but it was actually produced by Brooks Films, which was Mel Brooks' production company. Now, I'm sure there's an interesting story of how that came about, but I don't have that for you. I'm sure you will find out on the Wikipedia page for Eraserhead, but he did go on to produce The Elephant Man as well, his company at least. And The Elephant Man is, there's another film we're going to get to later on. It's one of Lynch's kind of straight films. It's based on an actual story that's not his own, and it's done in the style of how a film should be done. It's got a start, a beginning, and an end, and it's got a story to it. Do you see what I mean? And so many of his don't. But the story itself, we've all heard of The Elephant Man, a very sad, unfortunate individual who was born with a terrible disfiguring disease, which made some people opine that he looked like an elephant. And consequently, he would cover himself up with a bag over his face when he went out and what have you. And he was put in, you know, these circus things as one of the freaks to look at. People would pay money back then to see these people. Well, a doctor ends up seeing him, and he basically buys him off the circus where he works because he wants to study him. And the doctor is brilliantly played by Anthony Hopkins. I mean, this for me is one of his earliest performances, 1980. But the story I heard is that Anthony Hopkins was had a big problem with alcohol until 1974, when he woke up in a motel room in Phoenix and didn't realise how he got there. and it's my understanding he's never drunk a drop since. So he obviously had some sort of career in America at that time, and he was not a stranger to film. But there's a scene here where he sees the John Merrick character, the Elephant Man, who's played by... Why can I suddenly not think of his name? John Hurt. Who, interestingly, was up for Best Actor for this role the same year that that was won by Robert De Niro for Raging Bull. But anyway, he sees him for the first time, Anthony Hopkins, and he just, a tear just drops from his eye, and he apparently was just able to do that on cue. And it's quite an amazing part of acting. He obviously, Anthony Hopkins would go on to be known for many roles, particularly the Hannibal Lecter one, which would get him his Oscar. But probably what is far superior to that is a film he did called The Father, in which he plays someone suffering from Alzheimer's disease, dementia. And he played that role so well, and he got the Oscar for that. It was completely unexpected. I don't think he even appeared at the ceremony because he didn't think he was going to win it. He was just thought he was one of the names on the list type of thing. But he did win it, and having seen the film, I think deservedly so. But that's what the film's about. It's about a doctor rescues this guy from the theatre. He presents him to other people. He gets taken around high society functions. There's a high society lady who takes John Merrick under her wing, and it has its usual ups and downs, as a film like that does have. It's actually my girlfriend's favourite film, and I always have to be prepared whenever she finishes watching it, because she comes in crying after having seen it every time, even though she knows what's going to happen. Okay, so that was 1980. The next one up is 1984. It's June, which is a film I struggle to understand. Many of the films I've talked about, many people would not like, some of them because they've got horror aspects to it. One thing I found really disgusting me in this film, there's a character in it, some big fat guy who seems to be suspended in the air and covered in boils. And just, there's no horror or anything like that, but just the look at him, it really sort of turned my stomach. Do you know what I mean? So you have to be aware that different... I think this is where censorship goes so wrong. Different things offend different people. And if you were to take into account the feelings of everybody, you wouldn't release any content whatsoever, because there's always going to be something that will offend someone. And this is where we as a society have gone wrong. But I've stopped there, because this is not a political show, and I have to be careful because that's what I'm best known for. Okay, let's go over to Wikipedia to see what they say about the Dune film. So I'm on the second paragraph here. Let's see how long it is. The setting is the distant future, chronicling the conflict between rival noble families as they battle for control of the extremely harsh desert planet Arrakis, also known as Dune. The planet is the only source of the drug Melange spice, which allows prescience and is vital to space travel, making it the most essential and valuable commodity in the universe. Paul Atreides is the scion and heir of a powerful noble family whose appointment to the control of Arrakis brings them into conflict with its former overlords, House Harkonnen. Paul is also possibly the Kwisatz Haderach, a messianic figure expected by the Bene Gesserit sisterhood. So I'm already confused by that paragraph. I'm not doing very well. It's not a film for me. I'm not really interested in science fiction, fantasy, that type of thing. And it seems to weave all these things together. In a interview with Mark Kermode, the British film critic, on the bonus disc of the Inland Empire DVD, you can only find it on the two-disc special edition, David Lynch reveals that Dune is the only film of his that he did not have final cut. And he doesn't regard it as a film of his. He's sort of similar to what Stanley Kubrick did with Spartacus, again, because he didn't have final cut. So there are elements of the work in there, certainly involved, but because both of them were not happy with the final result. Both of them ultimately ended up disowning the film. They didn't go as far as to get themselves credited as Alan Smithy, which is what happens when someone involved in a film does not wish to be credited with it. They use the pseudonym Alan Smithy, that you can look up if you so desire. But nevertheless, the film, I understand, was disowned by David Lynch, as Spartacus was by Kubrick. Okay, and of course Dune has been remade, and it was remade as two films. So maybe it was on a hiding to nothing when they tried to release it as one film. I understand that it was originally the Kubrick, the Lynch version, I'm confusing myself now, was well over 3 hours. And of course it was beneath that when it was released. It was still long, 137 minutes, so that means that at least 43 minutes were cut from it. But it didn't make sense to me, but it wasn't helped by the fact that I was not interested in the subject, as I say, not being a big fan of science fiction or fantasy. So there you go. To some people, though, it is a cult film, and to other people, presumably there was an audience for it, which is why a remake was done over two films, which I believe did very well at the box office. Okay, so let's go carry on with his next film, which for me is his finest film, 1986's Blue Velvet. And this film, I'd describe it, it became what Lynch became best known for, taking a beautiful, idealistic American town setting where everyone lived in comfort and everyone was nice to everybody, and then there's something going on underneath that you don't see on the surface. And that theme would crop up in most of Lynch's films after that date. Now, the story itself, you've got Carl McLaughlin. He's a young man. His father has had a stroke or something, so he returns home from wherever he is, at college or whatever, I forget, to be with the family. And he finds, while he's out walking around, he finds a severed human ear in a park. And consequently, he sort of takes that to the police and he gets interested in the case. And it ends up that it leads him to a woman who's a nightclub singer, and he sort of follows her around and then discovers that she's being abused by a man played by Dennis Hopper in what is one of the roles probably most associated with Dennis Hopper. He does an amazing performance in that role, a shocking performance, and that is really what makes the film, the things that Dennis Hopper does and the extremes he's prepared to go to in acting the character. And it's that story of this young kid being confronted by a woman who's being abused by this man, and what does he do about it? And he goes to investigate more and more, and then, you know, he ends up being drawn into it and has all sorts of things happen to him. And it does actually have a proper story going through it and a proper ending, but I don't want to give that away. But when Hopper heard of this script, he approached David Lynch. And you see, at that time, he was not very welcomed in Hollywood. He was known for being an abuser of drugs and alcohol, and consequently not being reliable. And there are all these stories of him, to the extent that when Carl McLaughlin heard that Dennis Hopper was going to be one of the other lead roles on the film, friends of his in that field, in the acting field or whatever, said, "Oh my, you're going to have your hands full dealing with that guy." Do you know what I mean? And so he was quite worried. And then he said, but when he turned up on the first day, he said, Dennis Hopper turned up and he was so put together, you thought that he looked like a man who sort of ran a restaurant or something, I believe was the quote. And Dennis Hopper, apparently when he saw the script, said to David Lynch, he said, "I have to play Frank Booth because I am Frank Booth. That's what I'm really like." And when you see what the Frank Booth character gets up to in the film, it's really quite worrying if Dennis Hopper was actually being honest here. But the other thing I find about this film is its atmosphere, the beauty of the shots. What I found that David Lynch went wrong with in his later career is he thought the imagery would be enough to carry him through without a story to keep the audience interested. But here you get the story as well as the imagery, and the whole thing comes together for what I believe to be David Lynch's masterpiece. That takes us on to 1990's Wild at Heart. And this film is David Lynch's homage to The Wizard of Oz. And there's all this Wizard of Oz imagery in there. You've got the lead characters, Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern, and they're a couple that wants to be together, but Laura Dern's mother desperately wants to keep them apart, to the extent that she'll get a hitman to try and take Nicolas Cage out, her daughter's boyfriend, and she's kind of portrayed as the Wicked Witch, if you like, in the film. And it's really a road trip. It's what they get up to as they're going around different places. And where I found Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart tedious was the lengthy interactions between the, in the case of Blue Velvet, the Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern characters, boyfriend, girlfriend, and Wild at Heart, the Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern characters. So Laura Dern would become a favourite of Lynch's, as you will find out later in this broadcast. But what makes it again for me? David Lynch, at this point in his career, really knew how to do a villain. And he did it in such a way that the villain in this one is a guy played by Willem Dafoe, called Bobby Peru. And in his first scene, he comes out, he says, "The name's Bobby Peru, like the country." And he's got these teeth that are obviously prosthetics that have been done for the film, where he's got these huge gums, bottom and top, with these tiny little teeth poking out about a millimetre. And he does this thing with his, it really looks awful, and he uses it when he laughs and what have you. It's just very disturbing, showing these teeth and gums that he's got, and that clearly adds to his performance in this film. And there's a scene here that I'll always remember, in which there's no nudity, but it's very disturbing. He's sexually abusing, more psychologically than, as I say, there is no nudity, but there is manhandling involved. He's sexually abusing the Laura Dern character. And at some point, he just jumps back and says something you're just not expecting, and you laugh, and you think, I can't laugh. I shouldn't laugh. You know, this is a horrible person doing a horrible thing, but he does this thing so unexpected. And this, for me, is what Lynch is good at. He did similar things with Frank Booth. Again, a character more horrible, in my opinion, than the Bobby Peru character in Wild at Heart. But there are scenes that he does things and says things. And even though he's such a despicable human being, you have to laugh. And it's not nervous. It is actually funny. And then you become disturbed yourself that you're actually prepared to see humour in anything characters such as Frank Booth or Bobby Peru do. That, for me, is David Lynch. That was what he was good at. And the other aspects of, you know, the way he frames a shot and what have you, I've never been so interested in. I think the most important thing to me in a film is the storyline. And that's why I can sit through something like those two early David Cronenberg films, Shivers and Rabid, and when they look like the colours all drained out of them, you know, the way some of those 1970s video nasties looked. But if the story is interesting enough to carry it through, obviously you want the picture as good as you can get it. You could argue the closing scene in Taxi Driver, which was deliberately, I think the word is, desaturated of colour, so that the blood wasn't so prominent. But unfortunately, they did it to the negative, presumably because they're not able to restore it today. So that's my opinion on those films. And before we get into the next film, Twin Peaks Firewalk with Me, I'm going to take a little diversion, because When I hear about this film, I'm always reminded of a quote from Quentin Tarantino. Now, the quote is, let me just find it here. He said, "I'm not ragging on other people, but after I saw Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me at Cannes, David Lynch has disappeared so far up his own ass that I have no desire to see another David Lynch movie until I hear something different." Now, that's the quote that you find all over the internet. And it's from an article. I'm on a page from LAweekly.com, which is called Mr. Blood Red Ella Taylor's 1992 Quentin Tarantino Profile, originally published October 23rd, 1992. But this LAweekly.com article is dated August 19th, 2009. But let's go back. Now, if you want to look this up yourself, you've got to go down to the second to last paragraph, and it's about two-thirds of the way down in that. But that's where the quote ends. However, that's being a bit disingenuous to Quentin Tarantino, what he was saying, because I'll read you the full quote. "I'm not ragging on other people, but after I saw Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me at Cannes, David Lynch has disappeared so far up his own ass that I have no desire to see another David Lynch movie until I hear something different. And you know, I loved him. I loved him." So, big David Lynch fan who was disappointed by a film that he did. So that's very different, you know, from missing that last section of the quote that most versions of the quote do. But that leads me to think, well, let's have a look at Quentin Tarantino's work, shall we, very briefly. So I've gone over to the Quentin Tarantino page on Wikipedia, scrolled down to filmography. It starts off in 1992 with Reservoir Dogs, which I first got a pirate copy of at university. Everyone was talking about it. And for me, what I loved about the film, Tarantino famously was being interviewed with Brian De Palma, and he said, when people talk about Reservoir Dogs, they say, oh, that's a film where a guy gets his ear cut off. And he was really annoyed by that it was put into that little narrow category, that narrow interpretation of a film. But for me, what worked was at the start, where they're talking in the cafe, all the different things that these gangsters were talking about to each other that I'd never seen before. And when you look at sort of gangster films, they are talking generally about what they're up to in their gangster life. But Tarantino said, you know, these people, they listen to the radio, they eat food, they do other things as well. They don't just talk about their time as a gangster. And you know, there are elements of that in Goodfellas. You see family life and you see them talking about different things and with their wives, stuff like that. But you can see his point that the actual genre, if you like, the gangster genre, was very narrow, and he broadened it out by showing these people talking about regular things that other non-gangsters would talk about. And I like that a lot more than any of the sort of violence in the film, because it was new and interesting to me. But then there's a scene with the Michael Madsen character, Mr. Blonde, wasn't he? And then the nice guy character played by Chris Penn, in front of Chris Penn's father, played by Lawrence Tierney. And they're sort of play fighting and they're saying things to each other, and the language in there and the things that they're saying really, I felt quite revolting. And I think he should have cut that scene out, because it's very off-putting in the film. It doesn't really fit in either. You know, you've got the build-up, then you've got them in the warehouse and people arriving, and then you've got that sidebar where they go off there. I think that the sidebar in the film where they go off to the Tim Roth character being briefed by his police handler as an undercover agent, I apologise if you've not seen it and that's a spoiler, but I imagine most people who want to see Reservoir Dogs have seen it by now. It's such a famous film and it's been out 34 years. That is a sidebar scene as well, but that works for the film, I think. But it would be interesting actually seeing the film without those scenes in. And I think that the film really only came in at about 90 minutes. Let me have a quick look. 99 minutes. So most directors really want to make a film a minimum of 90 minutes. It really has to be that to be a film. You get some at 84, stuff like that. But I think that the film would probably work with just the scenes of the robbery, the start when they're in the cafe, and the scenes in the warehouse. And I think that would work better maybe than with the other scenes. Now, following Reservoir Dogs, we're going to jump away from the Quentin Tarantino filmography for a second. Because what he did was he'd written some screenplays. Reservoir Dogs was one of them, and that was the one that he chose to direct. But he also wrote True Romance and Natural Born Killers. And he sold those in order to finance Reservoir Dogs. Consequently, True Romance was made by Tony Scott. And that's like a sort of road movie. You've got a cast in there. The lead characters are played by Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette. It's a very exciting film, and it's got a supporting cast. I mean, I'll give you some of the names. Christopher Walken, Dennis Hopper, Gary Oldman. I mean, I remember someone at the time saying to me, it sounds like everyone was queuing up to be in that film after the success of Reservoir Dogs, because even though Tarantino wasn't directing it, it had his name on it as the writer, and Tony Scott was directing it. He probably best known for Top Gun, but for me this is Tony Scott's best film. And it's, if you like a road movie, I'm not going to get into it too much, it's well worth watching, and it's probably one that I would watch again. And again, the dialogue in there is its strength for me. And Tarantino can write some very amusing dialogue. Some of it I like, some of it I don't, but the stuff I like I hadn't heard elsewhere, and that's what made the film exciting. And then the other film that he sold, Natural Born Killers, would be bought by Oliver Stone. And I'm not going to get into that too much today, because that might be something, just giving you a little hint of who I plan to cover in tomorrow's The Films Of show, which will be the final show in the series. So we'll get into that there. But I will say that I believe that both of those films, with different directors, Tony Scott and Oliver Stone, were probably better, in my opinion, than anything Quentin Tarantino's ever done as a director. I thought they were better. So it's interesting from that point of view, would Reservoir Dogs have looked better with another director? I think it's a good film. I think that some of the language in it has really suffered the test of time. That's kind of where I am with that. So let's return to his filmography. 1994, you've got Pulp Fiction, which many people would say is his best film. I think it probably is. Again, the things that happen in the film, it's one of these non-linear narratives. And so it doesn't start where it should start. It sort of starts in the middle and goes round to the middle type of thing. But it's... how to describe it? I mean, you've got different stories. You've got Bruce Willis playing a boxer who's asked to throw a fight, and what happens with him. You've got a couple of gangsters who are go over to a motel room to collect a debt owed to their boss. You've got what happens to a gangster when he has to take his boss's girlfriend out, and he's really worried about it because, you know, he's heard that his boss, someone else, was trying to help her out, and he apparently did something which caused the boss to have him thrown out of a window. So he's very worried about getting involved. So there's all these different storylines there, and they all sort of converge, and it's a very exciting story. One thing that I did before Pulp Fiction came out, and the other thing I neglected to mention with Reservoir Dogs that really made it a good film, is the music, the soundtrack. And it was all different songs that I hadn't really heard before, but they were all really catchy songs that were some of like Quentin Tarantino's favourites from like the 1970s. And I had the soundtrack album. And when I heard that Pulp Fiction was coming out, I actually bought the Pulp Fiction soundtrack on cassette. That's what I was using at the time, because I thought it'd be interesting to know the soundtrack to the film before you see a film, because it came out in the UK before the film did. And unfortunately, apart from the song Son of a Preacher Man, which I thought was very good and I hadn't actually heard before either, there wasn't a lot on that soundtrack that I really appreciated in the same way as I did Reservoir Dogs. But Pulp Fiction, I don't want to give too much of a game away. If you haven't seen it, obviously it's Tarantino. You're going to have bad language, you're going to have violence, but there's a lot of humour in there as well. And it did actually win the Palme d'Or at Cannes, which Tarantino was invited to Cannes, and he didn't expect it to win the Palme d'Or. I think he thought it might walk away with something, but he was genuinely shocked. You can actually see a clip of his speech receiving the award out there. So there you go. That takes us on to a film that's not in the list, but I've got in my hand, and it is 1995's Four Rooms. Now, the reason it's not in the list is in the same way that 1989's New York Stories was not on Martin Scorsese's filmography, just like 1993's Body Bags was not on John Carpenter's filmography, and that is because they direct a segment of the film, but not the whole film. So you'll find it in supplementary notes on the Wikipedia page. But to be in the main filmography, I think they have to have directed the whole feature. That is a rule. It appears, based upon those two films and on this one, on Wikipedia. But Four Rooms has a... It's directed by four different people. Like the other two, you've got a character who links the stories together. In New York Stories, you've got the doorman, played by Paul Herman. And he's sort of difficult to spot. And in Body Bags, John Carpenter's the morgue attendant. And then in Four Rooms, you've got the bellboy. It takes place in the hotel, played by Tim Roth. But the four segments are directed by Alison Anders, Alexandra Rockwell, Robert Rodriguez, and, of course, Quentin Tarantino. For me, the only segment worth watching is the Quentin Tarantino segment. And he plays a wealthy Hollywood, is he a director or an actor or something like that? And he's been partying with his friends, and he has a bet with someone based upon an old, I think it was some old television show segment, where a guy bets money if he can light his lighter 10 times in a row without it just sparking, it has to go to a flame 10 times in a row, then that they have a bet. And if he does it, then he'll give him his car, which is worth tens of thousands of pounds. It's a very good car. But if the guy fails to light the lighter any one of the 10 times, then the bellboy will chop his finger off, little finger off. And it's based upon some television show in which that scene was done. And it's an exciting story. It's fairly short because you've got the four films, and the whole film itself is only 94 minutes. So you're not going to be looking at probably more than 25 minutes for that segment. But for me, it's one of the finest. It's the last great bit of filmmaking that Quentin Tarantino did, which takes us on to 1997's Jackie Brown, which was a Elmore Leonard novel. So he's using the writing of someone else here. It stars Pam Grier as an air stewardess, and it's got other people in there, like Samuel L. Jackson comes back from Pulp Fiction. You've got Robert De Niro appearing in the film. I have to click on it because I can't think of her name. I know she's, let me see. No, Bridget Fonda. Yeah, Bridget Fonda. Michael Keaton. Robert Forster. Now, Robert Forster, I understand, was already drawing his SAG pension when he got called up to do this film, because he hadn't been offered any acting roles for quite some time. So he was kind of called out of, not retirement that he wanted, but if you're not being hired, what do you do? And he would go on to resurrect his career and famously appear, I think his last appearances were in the Better Call Saul spin-off of Breaking Bad. Excuse me, none of these shows would be complete without me coughing. I do apologise, I wish I didn't have to. Cough, not apologise, that is. So anyway, Jackie Brown is a air stewardess. She gets involved in some sort of drug thing. She gets found out because she's trying to smuggle drugs. And that kind of started the film off in the wrong foot for me. There's a film called Midnight Express about a guy who tries to run drugs out of Turkey, an American student, and things happen to him which aren't pleasant. And does he really deserve what he got, how he was tortured in a Turkish prison and what have you, because he tried to smuggle drugs? Well, that's a matter of opinion. Some people would say, that's over the top. Some people who may have known someone who died of drugs might think differently. But I find it very difficult to find sympathy for somebody involved in that sort of thing. And I think any sort of film character, there has to be an element in the film that sort of, you have to feel something for someone. Sometimes it might even be you've got a tremendous anger for somebody. You want to see them punished for what they've done. Something like that. You want that to be a film or a television show or what have you. But it started off like that. And she's an air stewardess. So they make out, oh, air stewardesses, they don't make a lot of money. Well, you know, I think they make more than quite a few people. And I don't think that they earn that little that they have to resort to drug smuggling. But that's basically the story. And she gets involved with a bail bondsman played by Robert Foster. And it got very tedious for me. And this was really the turning point for me with Quentin Tarantino. Although I would continue to see his films, not, though, including Kill Bill Volumes 1 and Volumes 2. Now, I've never been interested in Kung Fu. When I was younger, we had a cartoon called Hong Kong Fooey, and I wasn't interested in it then, and I'm not interested in it now. And the idea of a director of what you could argue would be male-dominated films such as Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction to do a film with all these women doing Kung Fu, I couldn't see how he would retain his audience. He certainly lost me there, but he would go on to become more and more successful. So clearly I was in the minority, and I can't comment on those two films. What I can comment on is 2007's Death Proof, which starred Kurt Russell in a very unsympathetic role. He's like some sort of stunt driver, and it just car chases and car races all over the place. And there's a bizarre scene in which some girls are driving a car, and one of them chooses to hang on to the hood of the car, and she's like hanging on there, and it's just car chase after car chase, and I just found the whole thing very tedious, very boring, and not for me. 2009 Inglourious Basterds and 2012's Django Unchained, I did not care for the subject matter. The only thing I thought was good in those films is the performance of Christoph Waltz, who I thought deservedly got the best supporting actor Oscar in both films. And to that point, he was the only actor ever to get a Oscar for an appearance in a Quentin Tarantino film. It would be matched by Brad Pitt in 2019's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I'm going to get to next, because I never watched The Hateful Eight, as I understood it was a similar vein to these other two films I didn't like. And it's also a Western, and the only Western I like is The Outlaw Josie Wales. I do have Unforgiven, and I do have the Sergio Leone trilogy, you know, the A Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More, and the other one that's the most famous that for some reason I can't quite remember now, in like one little box set. But I think I've seen it the once and I've no desire to see it again. The Hateful Eight, I was actually in a charity shop and it was there for £1 on Blu-ray. So you're not going to do much better than that. And I still did not buy it. What I did buy, even though I'd given up on Tarantino by this point, was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because it was £5 for £1 in some DVDs in the charity shop. This is his last film, which came out in 2019. And I just found it ridiculous. It opens up with a scene in which Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio, one of them's an actor and one of them is his stuntman. I think Brad Pitt's the stuntman, Leonardo DiCaprio's the actor. And they're being interviewed by a guy who looks to me like Stephen Graham, but he's not in the credits. I've tried to look it up, but who is this guy? He looks like Stephen Graham, but apparently it's not Stephen Graham, because I can't see it attributed to him anywhere on the internet, but I could have sworn it was him. And it's set around the time of the Manson murders, but instead of Sharon Tate being murdered, she ends up doing all this kung fu and killing the murderers. It's just one of the most ridiculous, pointless exercises I've ever seen in filmmaking. A complete waste of my time. And that is probably the last time I will ever go to a Tarantino film. He is due to do one more, because what he said is he's only ever going to direct 10 films. Now, being as you think, well, Kill Bill 1 and 2, that takes him to 10 films. Well, no, he regards Kill Bill as one film. So although it was released in two volumes, that means he's up to 9, and he's got one film left to do. And that would take him to the 10 films, which, funnily enough, is the same amount of films that David Lynch did in his lifetime. And we return to David Lynch now with Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. Saw it less than 24 hours ago, just after 5 p.m. yesterday, and I couldn't really understand what was going on. Funnily enough, I picked up the first season of Twin Peaks at a car boot sale for 50p. I imagine that goes for a lot of money, I think, on the internet at the moment. And I watched the pilot episode in its entirety. I found it very boring. The only thing and I end up watching the subsequent episodes on Fast Play. The only thing I liked about Twin Peaks is the opening credits. You've got beautiful theme tune by Angelo Badalamenteri, who I'm probably mispronouncing. And that theme tune suddenly pops up in Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me about 40, 50 minutes into the film. So it's great to actually have that, because I got rid of this series. But the other thing it has is the opening credits. It shows the town of Twin Peaks. So it's got this little bird sat there, and it's such a pretty image. And again, it takes us back to, there's all these sorts of, it looks such a lovely place, but there's all these horrible goings on under the surface that only very few people know about. And it makes me wonder if David Lynch had some sort of problem with classic small town Americana. I believe he grew up in a small town. I mean, and sometimes people have a resentment for that. I know that Andy Warhol famously wanted to make no reference to the small town upbringing that he hated, and, you know, went to New York, and that was where he wished to spend his life. Incidentally, Kim Newman recounted a tale in which Andy Warhol, on one of his commentary tracks, in which Andy Warhol was once forced to watch one of his films, I think Sleep, which is 5.5-hour film of a man sleeping, and he was tied down in a cinema and forced to watch it, and the people who tied him down, when they got back, they found that he chewed through the ropes and escaped. But I'm not sure if that's true or not. You might have to look that one up. I have, and they say it's a urban myth, but there can be some truth in urban myths, so I guess we'll never know. But anyway, let's go back from my digression to Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. Imagery, not a lot of story. There are some scenes I can remember of films, because all these films I'm going to recount to you I've seen in the last week. But it just, I have to agree with Quentin Tarantino on this. I don't know what was going on. It's a very strange film. But in the Mark Kermode interview of David Lynch that I referred to earlier from the Inland Empire DVD, he says that he regards Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me as David Lynch's finest film. So it's all horses for courses at the end of the day. Some people obviously rate it. I don't. Let me click on it to see if I can just tell you what it says. It's second paragraph of the Wikipedia page on the film. Greenlit shortly after the TV series was cancelled, Fire Walk With Me has a much darker tone than the TV series and does not address many of season 2's unfinished narratives, including its cliffhanger ending. Although most of the television cast reprised their roles for the film, many comparatively light-hearted scenes featuring town residents were cut. In addition, the series' main star, Kyle MacLachlan, asked for his role to be downsized, and Lara Flynn Boyle's character, Donald Haywood, was recast with Moira Kelly. In 2014, several deleted scenes were recut and released as a compilation film titled Twin Peaks: The Missing Pieces. Well, for me, there were a lot of missing pieces in that film. It made no sense. And that takes us on to 1997's Lost Highway. Now, there are three bits of this film I remember, and I remembered it from seeing it whenever I first saw it years ago, because I had a copy, got rid of it. And I'll go through them. There's one scene where a guy's at a party and someone comes up to him, who I've since found out is the actor Robert Blake. Now, funnily enough, Robert Blake, he was accused of murdering his wife, went to trial, got found not guilty, but could never get an acting role again. O.J. Simpson was accused of killing his wife, got found not guilty, and he could never find an acting role again. It makes you wonder why the two didn't form their own repertory company in order to try and get some business. But I digress. He is a character at a party, Robert Blake, and he goes up to, I think Bill Pullman is the lead character, one of them, in Lost Highway, and he says to him, "I'm at your house." And he's just looking at him. He's a creepy looking character. He's got like a white face and what have you. And Bill Pullman, you know, who's this guy looking at him? And he gives him a phone. He says, "Call me." And so Bill Pullman calls his house, and this guy standing in front of him is talking on the phone at the other end. It's just bizarre. And there's another scene where you've got a guy in jail who's killed his wife, and he's having a bad time of it. And there's one of the jailers says to the other, "That wife killer's really struggling at the moment." And the other guy goes, "Which one?" And that was quite amusing. And then the other scene is a scene starring, he's not in the lead characters, which is, there he is, Robert Loggia. And he's being tailgated while he's in his car. And in the end, he lets the guy go past him. When the guy goes past him, he floors his car and literally drives this guy off the road. He's got a powerful Mercedes-Benz. And when he's driven the guy off the road, he gets him out of the car and absolutely lays into him, both verbally and physically. And apparently, Robert Loggia was up for the part of Frank Booth in Blue Velvet, but of course it went to Dennis Hopper, and he said he did that scene based upon the way he felt towards David Lynch when he wouldn't give him the part of Frank Booth. I think he may have even expressed that to David Lynch as well, but that was quite a shocking scene. And of course Robert Loggia would be best known as Al Pacino's boss in Scarface, where Al Pacino murders to take over his drug syndicate, and of course as Feach LaMarna in a couple of the latter series of The Sopranos. So I believe he was actually, I was just in season 5, he was released from prison at the same time as the Steve Buscemi character and had a memorable role over just a few episodes of that season. So that's all I really remember from the film, but apparently what it is it's a guy who murders his wife, and he's trapped in a time loop where it keeps happening because the Bill Pullman character suddenly disappears and is replaced by another character who seems to be another actor who seems to be the same person. But as I say, it all gets very confusing, and I sat through it, but I doubt I'll be sitting through it again. If I do, it'll be just to fast forward to those scenes that I referred to. So let's move on to The Straight Story. Now, this is another great by David Lynch, and I didn't like it the first time I saw it because I was like, this is not a David Lynch film. Well, based upon what I've told you about David Lynch so far, do you think that he would be considered as a Disney director? Well, get this. The Straight Story was rated U, which is basically anyone could watch it in the UK. It's a Disney film. It was released in 1999. And it's about a guy, it's a true story. And what happened? I'm going to read it just so I don't miss things out. But it's a true story. There was a guy called Alvin Straight. And in 1994, he travelled across Iowa and Wisconsin on a lawnmower. And basically, his legs and his eyes were too impaired for him to hold a driver's license. His brother had had a stroke and he wanted to visit him and he wanted to get there himself. So he put a big trailer on the back of his lawnmower with all his sort of camping equipment and food and what have you in there. And the lawnmower had a maximum speed of 5 miles per hour. And it was a 240-mile journey from Lawrence, Iowa to Mount Zion, Wisconsin. And that's a true story that happened. Now, the actor who played him, Richard Farnsworth, was terminally ill when, and he was aware of this, was terminally ill when he agreed to do the part. And the reason he agreed to do the part was he felt, he so admired the achievement that Alvin Strait had done, that he felt that he owed it to his legacy to, you know, even though he was in pain, it's going to be difficult, he was going to do that role. And it's a wonderful story about almost like a road movie as well. He meets people on the way, different people he encounters, and then a little surprise at the end when he gets to see the brother. A very beautiful film, and one that I owned, got rid of, and then it was actually a good film. I just didn't see it as a David Lynch film, but very beautifully shot. And again, it works. If you've got a story, then, oh, well, I'm enjoying this, and oh, isn't that a beautiful image of farmland and the sky, and it looks lovely out there, doesn't it? But it doesn't work if you don't know what's going on. So, but that takes us back to one of the most praised of all of David Lynch's films, and that's Mulholland Drive from 2001, which I detested, really. You've got a woman, a couple of stories going on. There's a woman who's getting an acting role. She ends up renting an apartment, and there's a woman already in there who's got amnesia. And they find out that she's been fleeing from some mob or something or other. And there's a director in there who's finds out his film is being financed by the mob. And all their lives converge, but I found the whole thing very tedious, and it's not for me. But again, I'm in the minority. Many people regard this as David Lynch's finest work. But his final film, 2006, Inland Empire, it had an interesting premise at the start. You've got Laura Dern is the lead role, and I believe it was her idea. She's even, I believe, a producer on the film. She said she wanted David Lynch to direct her in the next film, and this took a number of years to do. For some reason, Lynch decided to shoot it. For a man who's so obsessed with all his camera work, why he decided to shoot it on a low resolution handheld Sony DSR PD150 camcorder is anyone's guess, but that's what he decided to do. I don't think it was for budgetary reasons, because it still had $3 million paid on it, and it made 4.4. But it starts off, you've got a director, played by Jeremy Irons, and he's generally good value, Jeremy Irons, as an actor. And he's assisted by Harry Dean Stanton, who's another great actor. So they're together working on this film. They hire Laura Dern and some other actor to play the lead roles. And then they're having a meeting about the film, and then Jeremy Irons reveals, he says, have any of you heard this? But I haven't heard, he said, that only heard recently, that the film we're doing, it's actually a remake, but it's a remake of a film that was never finished, because the two lead characters died before it could be finished. So it sounds, well, this sounds interesting now. You've got a couple of actors hired to act in a film that, when it was previously attempted, they both died. So it sounds like quite an intriguing story could be coming up. But that's where the story ends. And you're subjected to, it comes in at 2 hours, 52 minutes, I think. So it's a lengthy piece. And it was a real slog watching it. And it's just imagery after imagery. People walking round, but people sitting in a lounge, one of them ironing, wearing bunny heads. I mean, just bizarre imagery such as that that makes no sense whatsoever. I'm sure some people out there made sense of it, but I'm not one of them. So I'm going to leave it there. That is the films of David Lynch. And I plan to be back with you tomorrow for the final part of this series, which is going to be the films of Oliver Stone. So what I presented to you today is not the subject I'm best known for, but after having my God-given right to free speech stolen from me by the very people who are supposed to protect it, it has been a joy to be able to speak freely on this subject today. It was not until I did it that I realised how much I missed it. If you enjoyed this episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents and have the financial wherewithal to do so, then please support the show by clicking the blue donate button at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. The more donations I get, the more shows you get, and in the meantime, thank you for listening, and bye for now.